The Lighthouse of Stalingrad, the hidden truth at the center of World War II's greatest battle, is a new book by Ian McGregor, looking at the crux, the focal point of one of the most important flashpoints, important points of the Second World War, or the Great Patriotic War, as the Soviet Union would call it. Here to tell me more about the Lighthouse at Stalingrad is the author of the book, Ian McGregor. Ian, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
The pleasure is indeed all mine. Stalingrad is one of those cities that you just mentioned the name, and it conjures up images of deprivation, of hardship, but also of the turning of the tide. Just if you would set the scene for us as the run-up to Stalingrad and what exactly the lighthouse was, because it wasn't, because as far as I can remember, there's no great coast by Stalingrad, or am I completely wrong?
No, it's in the heart of the Russian steppe, the Russian countryside, which is the great big swathe of arable lands that is to the east of Ukraine, which is obviously what many people are talking about now. And that's the breadbasket, always has been the breadbasket of that part of Eastern Europe. And Stalingrad was a city that, it's a bit like Chicago, actually. It mirrors Chicago in the fact that it was a small trading hub for 200 years before the Industrial Revolution. And then once that had caught up, then you get the links for the trains. It became a big transportation hub. It's situated right by one of the greatest rivers in Europe, the River Volga, which is about 1,500 kilometers long, goes from way above Moscow in the north all the way down and empties into the Caspian Sea in the south. So it's a great transportation area. And then once the communists had taken over and Joseph Stalin was in charge in the 1920s, it was recreated and rebuilt as this showcase Soviet city. So it had an amazing set of boulevards, squares, new apartment blocks, electricity and gas, cinemas, theatres, department stores. Can you imagine that for peasants living out in the countryside? And then three giant factories, which were housed in what was called the factory district in the north. And that's where the bulk of the 400,000 citizens who were there by the start of the Second World War work. So it was turned over into a massive weapons factory. It was making farming equipment for the rest of the Soviet Union right up until the beginning of the war, because it was part of Stalin's five-year plans of leapfrogging in industrial terms into a modern state. But obviously it was then these factories were turned into manufacturers of weapons, specifically tanks and armored boats and planes. And these were obviously, so it's a fundamental military target, I suppose, for the Germans. But from 1942, it was Hitler's big second offensive, his first offensive the year before, Operation Barbarossa, biggest invasion in history with 3.5 million men, had failed. Hadn't destroyed his army, but both sides were. His army was deep inside Russia, Western Russia, just outside the gates of Moscow. His new plan was, right, I need to seize the oil. I need to seize Russian oil in the Caucasus in the south to keep my war machine going, especially now he declared war in America. So Stalingrad was in the path of the German blitzkrieg, and it was never meant to be the main target. It was always going to be a city that they were going to either besiege or quickly take, hold on to it, and then that was protecting their eastern flank as the bulk of the army would then go south, right down into the Caucasus for 1,000 kilometers, capture the oil fields, and then basically lock up southern Russia. And potentially, I wouldn't say knock Russia out of the war, but cripple Russia and cripple Russia's ability to supply its own armies with this oil if the Germans had it.
So
the lighthouse.
Yeah.
Sorry, go on.
Tell us about the lighthouse. Yeah, because you just said the lighthouse, and that's what we're all thinking, what is the lighthouse then?
The lighthouse is a building. It was a code name for a big building, a four-story apartment block that was in no man's land between the Russian and the German forces fighting in the heart of the city. It overlooked this big square called the 9th of January Square. And it had been a building that had been for basically the party elite and technicians and engineers that worked in the factory district. So this was like if you were somebody, you would live in this apartment block because it had the latest technology. And so obviously it was a ruin by the time they were fighting for it, because like the rest of the city, the rest of the city itself, it had been bombed to smithereens by the Luftwaffe before the German army attacked. So it was a lunar landscape of destruction. but the building still stood. It was reinforced concrete, and it had its cellars were still intact. It was driven out. The Germans that were occupying it, legendarily, were driven out by a small storm group, a team of Russian troops, elite troops, armed with machine guns and grenades. And then it was like the Alamo in America. It was defended by a small group, so the legend goes, for 58 days, and they held it off against massive German forces. But to the Russians on their maps and to their troops, its code name was the Lighthouse, because from the top of the building, you got an amazing 360-degree view for about 5 kilometers in any direction. So you could see what the enemy was doing, but you could also signal back to your bases and your route of supply that was coming over the Volga River, because the Russians were clinging onto a slither of land that wasn't even 100 meters deep in places on the western side of the city, where the city's like a big ribbon. It's 50 miles long and it just clings to the river. And so they were clinging onto these spaces, and they were supplying their troops at night across the Volga. So the Lighthouse was seen as this strategically important place. And also metaphorically, they saw it as waves of German attackers were lapping up against this Lighthouse and being beaten back.
Because if you look at the way that that Stalin and the Soviet hierarchy put a spin on the great, as they call the Great Patriotic War, I mean, no nation suffered as grimly as the Russians did, the Soviets did. I mean, they had huge, horrendous losses, and you could argue that, yeah, Soviet tactics were, you know, men are expendable. We'll just, yeah, throw wave after wave. So they needed something to hang this fight upon, and so something symbolic like the Lighthouse is going to be used, yeah, by. I mean, we call it now, wouldn't we? Call it spin, I suppose, now.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically the city was the fight for the city, and it was a live city, so it hadn't been evacuated. Stalin thought his troops would fight harder for a live city with citizens living in it. By the time the Germans arrived, there's 800,000 people in the city, only meant to have half that, but obviously refugees had swollen the population. By the end of the battle, 65,000 civilians died in the battle, and by the time the surrender of the Germans 5 months later, there was probably about 10,000 people crawled out of their cellars and the sewers, wherever they were hiding. They were the ones that were left. But yeah, you're right. The city was seen throughout Russia as a metaphor for the whole war, and it was like almost like a living organism. And that was the thing. It was like, we will defend this city to the death. We love you, beloved Stalingrad. These are the kind of propaganda headlines in the newspapers, the radio speeches, all eyes. Not just in Russia, actually. I was going to say, when I was doing my research, newspapers all across the world, from Cape Town in South Africa, Sydney, Australia, Delhi in India, obviously London, they were all reporting every day. There was some news article on the front pages of all the famous newspapers giving information about the battle. And there was over 400 Russian, Soviet Red Army, whatever you want to call them, war correspondents in the city, feeding through all these stories and news reports, obviously doctored and taken up by the censors to make sure they were going to tell the story that they wanted to tell, but to shore up the morale of the country. Because if Stalingrad had fallen, the perceptive viewpoint across the globe, not just in Russia, was if Stalingrad falls, Russia will be split in half. Russia potentially could be knocked out of the war.
And, I mean, it was, we talk about the symbolic nature of Stalingrad and what it means to the Soviet people, and what it means, it rings true in today, but it was brutal. I mean, I know it was with scenes you hadn't seen, street fighting. As you said, it was a live city. It hadn't been deserted, so there were people, as you say, cowering, sheltering in sewers, in basements, and this was, I mean, we're saying, you know, the Russians are holding, or the Soviets are holding off the German forces. I mean, daily bombardment. I mean, it must have been, yeah, absolutely horrendous.
Well, I mean, overall, for this city, I think it's something like nearly 3 million shells landed on the city, whether they're dropped by the Air Force, the Luftwaffe, or whether it's artillery shells or those famous Russian Katusha rocket launchers, over 3 million shells. The battle started at the beginning of September, finished at the end of January. In September alone, the Germans expended 25 million rounds of ammunition, 25 million rounds of ammunition in 1 month. And that's just the Germans. The destruction was enormous. A city 15 miles long, there was 12% of buildings left standing by the end. And that's why the famous shots you see, it's a lunar landscape. But yeah, I mean, it's like I said, it's seen as the embodiment of the suffering and the sacrifice Russians, and not just Russians. I was going to say there's almost 20 ethnic groups within the Soviet Union fought in Stalingrad, including Ukrainians. The general who took the surrender of the German commander, Field Marshal Paulus, he was from the Crimea. He was a Ukrainian, but had served in the Red Army, obviously, all his adult life. And 5 million Ukrainians served in the Red Army of 30 million, and 1.9 million of them died.
It's interesting, isn't it, when you look at the situation, and we're not going to go down that particular path, because this is...
I just
saying, because of what's happened and the current Russian tactics, which seem to be, you know, bomb Mariupol,
yes.
You know, flatten it, and then we'll take it over after that. And that's exactly what they endured during Stalingrad.
I was just going to say, you're absolutely right. It's literally the opposing forces of Stalingrad have been recast into the opposing forces, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
It's now the Russians that are the attackers and the Russians that are using massive aerial bombardments. But like you said, that's a different conversation.
In the whole sweep of history, and as you can probably gather, I'm a bit of an armchair historian myself, but when we come to these things, there are small snapshots that happen within that bring a humanity, or, you know, because we can talk about the tactical battles and what it meant and how it affected and what it meant for the rest of the Second World War, but there are certain bits and there are certain snapshots that spring to mind that make it, if you like, more relatable, or you can hang your knowledge off. And if anybody's a film buff, if you've seen Enemy at the Door, for example, which was the sniper film, I mean, these were the battles between, you know, Russia, Soviet snipers and German snipers, stuff like that.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, like the lighthouse, which is what I talk about and go into detail.
Yeah.
I mean, I sat in the city's archives and read, gosh, nearly 400 testimonies in a week of Red Army troops that had fought in the city centre. So the famous scenes you see from Enemy at the Gates, where Jude Law's coming across, that division he was with, the 13th Guards Rifle Division, is one of the main units I talk about in my book. And it's in the archives that I read all the testimonies from men who'd served there. So you're right, it's trying to figure out what is true and what's not true. And definitely there was sniper attacks. There clearly was, because they used it as a psychological weapon. It's a great terror weapon, because during the daytime, you just don't want to put your head above the parapet. You might get it shot off. But the number of kills that were attributed to various legendary Soviet snipers, I would take that with a pinch of salt.
Yeah, sure.
Again, I've read the records. The Germans had their own snipers, obviously. They were employed. Both sides had them. But like I said, I was going to say we're lucky we can get into the archives and check some of these. Obviously, with the situation at the moment, Western historians aren't going to get into any Russian archives for the foreseeable future. But that's what I wanted to check. I just wanted to look at this key story, because the lighthouse, which in Russia is called Pavlov's House, named after the sergeant, it's hugely significant to Russians. They're taught this from, you know, while they're at school. And as I said earlier, to Russians, the Pavlov's house is like the Alamo is to the Americans. It's very symbolic to their commitment and sacrifice.
You mentioned going into the archives and checking out what, you know, what the reports are. Because if you think of what happens after the war, so you're looking at 1945, your Cold War after that, you know, you've got and Stalin's pushing that narrative of the Soviet Union, this was the great defeat of Nazism and et cetera, et cetera, and you get all the Stalinist sculptures, et cetera, of heroic, slightly Western-looking Russians rather than, you know, people from Uzbekistan. Well, it's true, isn't it? Let's face it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's another conversation about how those areas have been sort of airbrushed out of Soviet history. But if you look at, you know, the suppression that, you know, Stalin put on the people, are these first person accounts that you used to research this book, are they still valid, or do you think there are the ones that have been lost, or are they actually, you know, very, very current, and there wasn't much sort of, if you like, censorship of what they were going through?
Oh, yeah, I mean, that was the surprising thing. So basically, the Panorama Museum is what it's called. It's on the banks of the Volga, and it was built in the 50s when Stalin had died. They'd already rebuilt the city. Stalingrad was named as one of 10 what they call hero cities that would be rebuilt almost immediately after the war because of what they'd gone through. So there was Leningrad. I won't name all of them, but there was Leningrad, Stalingrad. In Ukraine, there was Kyiv, Odessa. These were all rebuilt. And so once the new leadership was in charge of Russia, which was under Nikita Khrushchev, there was a slight liberalization. And so that's when the museum was built. And it was obviously to celebrate and commemorate the sacrifices of the soldiers. So what they did was there was a national campaign of advertising to say, did you fight in Stalingrad? Did you survive? Do you want to contribute to the archives and tell us what you did? So if you go to, well, you can't go to the archives, but what I did, there's literally thousands of these almost like school books. They're green, 48-page school books. And these were given to the veterans to write longhand about what their experiences were. And you've got to remember, there was something like over a million Red Army troops fought in Stalingrad. It's probably up to 2 million, actually, in lots of different units, lots of different divisions. So there are thousands of these testimonies. And as you read through them, obviously there are some where it's complete party propaganda, as in, you know, it's the way they speak, the language they're giving is very from the Communist Party.
Yeah, the heroic motherland, etc.
Exactly, yeah. But the more you read, especially when, because this didn't happen in one fell swoop, this process went on for the next 20 years. So right up until the early 70s, veterans were still writing into the museum director with their memories and correspondence and that kind of thing. So I was reading all this whole variety of material, specifically from what I just said earlier, this 13th Guard Rifle Division that was fighting in the heart of the city. And that just builds up a completely different picture. Because that's how I started to realize, well, the fight for this famous house, Pavlov's house, isn't what the history books tell us. Because obviously that this story came from a Soviet Red Army war correspondent writing as the battle was going on. So once you read the testimonies from people that actually fought in that building or were on the front line by the building for the whole period, you realize, well, there's a completely different story here. And I would imagine that's the same for the rest of the battle. If you dig deep enough, I could have stayed there for 6 months and looked at probably 10,000 testimonies. I only had 9 days and I looked at, like I said, nearly 400.
A couple of bits and pieces coming in on the social media. Dear Giles, the Russians only, this is from Jason, the Russians only just stopped the German advance so close to their objective, but the cost in Russian lives was appalling and incomprehensible. Please ask your guests so that people realize that with the craziness of the world now, the courage and sacrifice of the Russians in the Second World War. And also, did you know what the number of losses were? I mean, I suppose in a battle like that where it's house to house and bombardments, etc., you can only give estimates of casualties?
Yes. Like I said, the Russians, well, casualties-wise, it's 1.5 million for the Russians, and I think dead it was about 750,000.
Good grief.
But that's not just in the city itself. I mean, the Stalingrad front was hundreds of kilometers long, north and south of the city as well, because that's ultimately where you get this famous Russian counterattack, which would encircle the Germans. But within the city itself, yeah, I mean, it was a meat grinder, which is the famous term. It was a proper war of attrition. And famously, like I was saying about, if you watch Enemy at the Gates and Jude Law's division, the 13th Guards Rifle, and they're seen as heroes in Russia, quite rightly too. There was 10,000 of them went over, almost like in a kind of Saving Private Ryan sort of assault across the river into the city. And they took their objective, and then they got beaten back by a German counterattack, but they survived and they clung on, and they were there for the whole battle. And by the end of the battle, even though obviously they would get reinforcements to replace casualties, from the original 10,000 that went over from this division, there was just over 200 left.
Good grief.
That's a metaphor for the Red Army for the whole fight, really. I mean, the attrition rate was, it's normally you'd survive 24 hours. Once you'd been shipped across the Volga, you were lucky to survive 24 hours, whether you got serious wound or whether you were killed.
This coming in as well, another one in, from Gary, who's Stalingrad, the only battle in history where mice took part. Now, this is this will be your true or false question for you, Ian. The only battle in history where mice took part, they disabled German tanks attempting to break into the city on a rescue mission. The weather conditions were such that the mice got the tanks for warmth and ate the wiring. Not the only reason, but one for the mission's failure. And the famous German doctor's painting that troops viewed many in tears whilst under siege of the Madonna on Christmas Day 42 can be seen in the Carl Wilhelm Church, Berlin, this day. Mice involved in the battle, Ian? Is this a true story?
Oh, that's true. Yeah, it's completely true. But it wasn't in the city. So it was basically right. once the Russian counterattack had Operation Uranus, this giant enveloping, encirclement of the Red Army. So they were attacking the north and the south flanks, way outside the city boundaries. And then they closed 50 kilometers deep behind the city, and that encircled the army. But while that was going on, there wasn't many German reinforcements that could get, because basically it was the Germans' Axis allies were guarding the flanks, hundreds of kilometers outside the city, primarily Romanians, Hungarians, and Italians. And so what they had done was they had some kind of almost like fire brigade armored divisions that were situated in the rear, German, obviously, that would go into support if anything happened. So this, your listener's right. So basically this was the 20th Armored Division in the north. And because the Germans weren't expecting this counterattack, they were basically settling down for the winter. So in the city, they were building, reinforcing their fortifications and digging proper winter dugouts to survive the winter, because it's like minus 20 by the time. In the steppe, they dug pits for the tanks and they filled them full of straw so the engines wouldn't freeze. And this is where the mice come in. So the mice, obviously, they're trying to get the snuggest place. And mice being mice, they started chewing through the wiring. So when this 20th Armored Division was given the order to move north to support the Romanians being pushed back by this this counterattack, hardly any of the tanks could get moving because their wiring had been
destroyed. So we have heroic Russian rodents as well. You see, that's everything.
Indeed, we do.
What do you hope that people will take? And was this an eye opener for yourself, Ian? I mean, I know that you know your onions, as the saying goes, but surely when you lift a lid on something like this, and there are so many stories, and you know you get the truth behind the fiction and also the Stalinist propaganda.
Yeah, no, it's been amazing. It's been such a journey because I started it 3 years ago. And like I said, I went to the archives in lockdown, the first lockdown winter of 2019. So it was about minus 19 when I was there. And I was in this city about, 2,000 kilometers from home on my own, just walking through these empty streets, going to the archives. What I would say is, to back up the Russian, there's some amazing German material in there. There's a German combat commander whose memoir has lain dormant since he died in the mid-50s, and his family kindly gave me his memoirs and papers and diaries and everything. And he was a frontline combat commander, and he survived 5 months of the battle, and he actually surrendered the army. It wasn't powerless, it was this guy. But because his papers have lain dormant since 1956, no one knew that. And so I've managed to get all his material and put it into the book. And again, it gives a very personal, insightful look at what it was to try and fight and survive in this city. So the reader can see both sides. You can see what the Russians were up to, because I've got the first-person testimony, and you can see what the Germans were up to, too. So, yeah, it's been a great journey for me, because, like I said, I am a student of this, but to find so much material that I didn't know existed and gave me so much incredible insight, it's been one of the best things of my life as a historian.
The book is called The Lighthouse of Stalingrad. It's by Ian McGregor, who we've been speaking to today. Ian, as you can tell, I could probably talk about this for the rest of the day, I think, but I'm gonna crush the news, as we say. If people want to find out more information about you or about the book, do you have a website? Is there social media? Where can people get hold of you?
Yep, you can get my. I've got a website. It's just straight Ian. It's Ian with two I's. Ian MacGregor, MAC .com. I've got my website, and then I am on Twitter at Ian McGregor one, the numeral one. And then you can go to my publisher's website, which is Constable.
And the book will also be available as a virtual download from our own TRE virtual bookstore. The book is called The Lighthouse of Stalingrad. Ian, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.